Welcome to the podcast. I'm Angela Beaubier, and this is Life in the Talbot Settlement, brought to you by Tyrconnell Heritage Society and Backus Page House Museum. In this series, we will do our best to give you a full appreciation of the history of Western Elgin County in southwestern Ontario, from First Nations through the original European settlers to the 1950s. I'll cover one topic per episode, with the first eight setting the tone for who we are, where we are, and what we do here at Backus Page House Museum. Please follow us on all social media by searching at Backus Page House, spelt BACKUSPAGEHOUSE. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Inside this episode, we will explore the gardens at Fairwood Farm in Wallacetown, diary entries from Marinda Williams Pierce, and Colonel Talbot, the horticulturalist, to give you an idea of early plants, trees, and vegetables in Dunwich and Aldborough townships. Did you even know that Thomas Talbot was an avid horticulturalist? I didn't until I read the book Sidelights on the Talbot Settlement by Ella N. Lewis. If you aren't familiar with Thomas Talbot, I suggest going back and listening to episodes 1 and 2 of our podcast. Ella takes anecdotes from Talbot's peers who were guests at Port Talbot. Mrs. Anna Jameson, author of Winter Studies and Summer Rambles, visits Talbot in 1837, and she mentions he has a love of flowers and his 2-acre rose garden were from slips brought from the homeland, England and Ireland, and tenderly cared for on the long voyage. He would have cared for the rose cuttings on board ship from England to Canada. I like to imagine the cuttings were from Castle Malahide in Ireland, Talbot's family home. But alas, we have no resources to prove that. A rose bush at that time could have grown up to 6 feet tall and would look shrubby in nature. Their flowering season, typical for all old roses, was a short summer flowering when the entire bush would be covered in hundreds of blooms. By 1828, there were 2,500 varieties of old roses, as this predates the introduction of the China rose that we're more familiar with today. On a personal family note, a Beaubier ancestor chauffeured Anna Jameson when she collected information for her book. Anna mentions there were 16 acres of orchard at Port Talbot that included apples, pears, plums, and cherries. Wild strawberries and the same orchards are mentioned by another visitor, Lady Victoria Welby, who was maid of honor to Queen Victoria. She visits with her mother, Lady Emmeline Stuart Wortley, in June of 1849, and also describes the lilac trees at Port Talbot. Not far away is Fairwood Farm, just west of Wallacetown on Talbot Line, originally owned by William Pierce and his wife Anne Moorhouse. We have written memories by Eva Pierce, who lived there with her brother Stuart on the farm. A flower garden was surrounded by trees, and there were several connected plots for vegetables. 3 or 4 of the original pines were still standing in 1967 when Eva recorded her memories. By the front gate was a hemlock tree, native to Canadian swamps. A Norway spruce was in the garden because on the way to the doctor's office, the family saw little trees growing in the ditches, so the family stopped to pull one up, brought it home, and planted it. At the time Eva compiled her notes, it was 100 feet high, 3.5 feet through, and still growing. They think it's the same age as John Leslie Pierce, who found it. Eva's dad, William, used to say that they'd have to cut it down every spring because it took too much moisture from the gardens. One of his sisters would say that land isn't scarce, so the tree stayed up. In the garden to the west of the house was a feather tree. As this is a nickname the Pierce family used, we aren't sure what type of tree it really was. If you have a guess, please leave a comment or email the museum, info@backuspagehouse.ca. For years and years, it wouldn't bloom. It was ugly. One of the Pierce aunts hated it, and she was going to cut it down with an axe. The spring after she left, the tree burst into bloom. Maybe it should have been called the spite tree. It blooms in June every year with small petals and long stems in clusters about 3/4 of an inch. It's described like pure white shredded tissue paper. Walnut trees were everywhere at Fairwood, just like they are at Backus Page House Museum. Large California walnuts, which are reportedly good for nutcracking at Christmas time. As for flowers at Fairwood Farm, the Pierces had a syringe plant, mock oranges, and native tiger lily, a union rose with red, white, and streaked blooms. It was very delicate and hard to maintain. It was from the United States, and it was named for the British War of the Roses. There was a Michigan rose, a native rose, and the huge prairie green. The prairie green was old back in 1875, and still blooming in 1967 at the side of the house. The first lily they had was called the Canada lily. It may have actually been a trumpet lily that blooms from the end of July into August. When they cut and burnt the timber to clear the land for a field, these plants started blooming and still bloomed in the farm's fence corners. Even Stewart's mom, Rebecca, was the daughter of Robert and Mary Ellis Sifton. She was the oldest of eight kids. From what I gather, she was highly intellectual and could have done great work in her studies if her family wasn't always moving. After marrying, she continued her studies and took up gardening. Rebecca's garden was at the back of the house with a picket fence and a little gate. One quote says, "She had all of the nice flowers and used to grow her houseplants from seed," end quote. There were Johnny Jump-Up roses, in fuchsias of all color ranges, plus other greenhouse plants. Even Stewart's dad went in 1890 to Regina and brought back Saskatoon berry bush sprouts and a black currant bush. In 1967, both were still growing. Saskatoon berries ripen in early spring, and the birds love them. The family was still using the black currant bushes when they wrote these memories down. Begonias grew all along the front of the trees because they liked the shade. There were also white and red gardenias, and then crystal flowers. Now, I had to look this up to explain these, but they're a low North American herb with basal rounded leaves and greenish flowers. Then frilly flowers were an improved breed of the crystal flowers. They look like coral bells that got a perm with heavily ruffled leaves in shades of copper, caramel, and tan with pink flowers. Pendulas were for the hanging basket. The flowers of this plant are yellow and greenish yellow, and the name pendula means pendulous or drooping. So I can imagine these would look great hanging off of the hanging baskets. I will mention some farm additions that the Pierces did. They had a honey house under the elm tree, and the replica is now at Backus Page House Museum. At the corner of their honey house was a grapevine that grew up into the hemlock tree. It still produced fruit in the high parts. They were really sweet green grapes in the 1960s. Stewart liked to take care of the bees, but after nearly dying from bee stings three different times, the doctors told him he had to give it up. When he did give it up, he took to vegetable gardening, growing enough that he and Eva would have extra and be able to give some away to neighbors. The barns and the sheep house were built close to the house because they needed the most water. The sugar bush was a fair size and started with a few hardy maples. Sap was gathered in 40-gallon pails and carried by a yoke and manpower, boiled in a wood-sided pan, heated in an iron kettle, then poured back into the pan to finish. This system was later updated to an iron pan on a saving pole. They tapped 600 to 650 trees, getting 80 to 125 gallons of syrup on a good year. 40 gallons of sap only equal 1 gallon of maple syrup. The season stopped when the buds started to appear on trees, because that was the end of the quality syrup. They recollect prices went from 90 cents to a dollar and up to $6 by the end of it. Feeder pans and an evaporator were installed in 1906, updated to Grimm's evaporator in 1923. Help started leaving the farm, and they all had to stop with the maple syrup production. Three or four men were hired in the summer, added to the two men that stayed year-round for working. All were very nice. As for the property at Fairwood Farm, there were 250 acres of the original farm, which now is part of Wallacetown, plus the fairgrounds, and then other houses are built on it. Parts belonging to the Pierce aunts were sold and have traded hands a lot. The 217 acres that was left of the original farm faces number 3 highway to the north, but the house still faces the south. Unfortunately, in 2022, the remaining outbuildings and the house will be demolished. As for the family, both Rebecca and John Leslie Pierce were gardeners. Dad, also did field work, but his kids never saw him, so one day they asked if he knew how to plow, and he was very indignant. Eva describes her dad as a little short, heavy, chunky man. Now, grandmother Ann Moorhouse came with her family and the Dubins from Ireland in 1819, while the Pierce family came from Rhode Island and arrived in the Talbot Settlement in 1809. The Dubins didn't stay long. They went and moved to the Sydenham River. Ann Moorhouse married William Pierce, and they lived in the original homestead by the lake, which is just down the road from our museum. Ann was a weaver and was the eldest daughter of Fanny. Mary Ann, the other daughter, married young to John Simpson and didn't have time for all that fancy weaving stuff. Now moving on from Fairwood Farm, let's look at another Pierce family. Marinda William Pierce's diary notes from 1892 really give a wonderful synopsis of farm life. Often she writes only one or two lines on any given day, but for historians, that is pure gold. Marinda Williams married Thomas Pierce, and their farm on Iona Road was then willed to their son William in 1912, and he sold it to his brother Samuel Pierce. It's Samuel who sold the farm at half its value to the United Church in 1960 to become what is now Pierce Williams Christian Center, and I highly recommend that you visit. Marinda writes in April that her large amaryllis bloomed on April 29th, 1892. The amaryllis is an easy care houseplant that would have been kept inside on the windowsill. Now in May, the tomatoes and the onions are planted. She dug the garden on the 24th, and early apple trees fully bloomed by the 26th of May. The harvest would be in October, even though there's no mention of apples later in the diary. They hilled the potatoes that were planted on the 27th. Now, more soil or organic material is hilled up around the young potato seedlings so that only the top leaves stick out. Corn was plowed, and garden seeds were sown on the 28th, and geraniums were set out on the 30th. Now, these are tropical plants, and they need to remain in their winter storage until temperatures no longer fall before 10 degrees Celsius, so May 30th seems like a good time. On June 1st, she mentioned dahlias. They're not frost hardy. They're perennial, and this means that you can grow the same tubers year after year after year if they're protected from the freezing temperatures with your winter storage. So on June the 1st, she must have pulled them out of storage to plant them. On the 7th, they began planting corn, and they finished on the 9th. She then shares the dahlias, the tubers, with her neighbors. They sheared the sheep that month, and they got their cabbage plants on the 22nd. Probably those seedlings were about 5 to 7 weeks old at the time. All the neighbors shared their resources, so Sidney Silcox is mentioned sharing strawberries. And the bees become problematic for the family on June the 26th. Marinda then jumps into July, and they start attempting to sell their sheep. The hay is then drawn on the 7th through to the 15th. Other families are still working on theirs, and the boys of the family go to give their neighbors their help. The Pierces are all finished haying by the 19th of July. The berry patches ripen on the 11th, and then there's an interesting mention in her diary. They could see the northern lights. The gooseberries, they're ripe on the 6th, so preserves are started a few days later on the 19th. On the 21st, they're cutting wheat. And then pet cats were brought between neighbors' houses to catch rats. On the 22nd, they have an agapanthus bloom, which is also called Lily of the Nile, which is a perennial blue and white flower. Now in August, Marinda only writes a couple things, I think probably because she was busy. They finish the wheat about August 11th, and then they move on to oats and peas. Peas are finished on the 13th and oats on the 17th. It then mentions that she's still trying to sell wool on August 22nd. Then we just move right into September. There's elderberries on the 3rd. They start cutting corn on the 14th. They cut clover, preserve plums and pears on the 21st, so we assume also that they have an orchard. They sealed 2 gallons of tomatoes and dug potatoes on the 24th, and then 4 gallons more of tomatoes are sealed on the 27th. The mention of sealing also is what we would do today as canning. In October, those dahlias that we mentioned back at the beginning, they're in full bloom on October 2nd. She does more potatoes on October 4th and brings the plants from the garden on the 5th. On the 13th, bulbs are set out. I really wish she had told us what flowers she was planting. And then she mentions peonies. They were lifted on October 17th. Apparently that's the best time to move them because the plant is dormant. sometime between October and March. You dig around the roots, disturbing as little of the root ball as possible, and transplant them to their new home. Peonies can even be divided to make new plants when you lift them. They set bulbs on the 18th, which also means planting the bulbs. On October 20th, 1892, Marinda mentions there was an eclipse. So I looked this up. This was a deep partial eclipse, with 91% of the sun covered for viewers closest to the center. This provided a significant spectacle for anyone who saw it. Now, all through the month of October, they were threshing. And on October 28th, she records their bushel count for their crops that year. 1,092 bushels of wheat and 1,700 bushels in total grain. So they must have had other crops that she hasn't mentioned. On November 5th, they send the wheat to St. Thomas at 63 cents a bushel, and she makes homemade catsup, which is the old name for ketchup. At the very end of the diary, she mentions that the government people came to evaluate the cows and determined they held no diseases. She then has the flowers brought up, the beets dug, and the cabbage brought in by November 8th. Unfortunately, that's all that we have written when it comes to farming and gardening. But I do think that this is quite a bit of information firsthand from an example farm. I hope you'll join us next week, and thank you for listening. Share the podcast with your friends and follow us on all social media platforms at Bacchus Page House. The Bacchus Page House Museum and Turkanal Heritage Society acknowledges the land we are on today as the traditional territory of First Nations people, the Attawandaron and the Iroquois. As settlers at a settler-focused museum, we value both the significant historical and contemporary contributions of all original peoples and ask how we can be supportive in Indigenous cultural renewal. Life in the Talbot Settlement is a production of Turkanal Heritage Society, operators of Bacchus Page House Museum, funded by the Department of Canadian Heritage. Your host has been Angela Beaubier. Music provided by Jack Whitmer. Thanks to our producer, Caitlin Rietzma. To make a charitable donation and to contact the Bacchus Page House Museum, visit our website, www.bacchuspagehouse.ca. And thank you for listening.